Oh, you didn't know. Yo ass better call somebody. Right, I'm going to read Jimmy's story now. This is part two of an as yet untitled podcast. I don't know what I'll call it. I've been talking about the first assignment that I've been doing for my advanced creative writing class. No, so I have to get the word advanced in there every time. I just want you to know that I'm not operating on a normal plateau, but no normal plane here. I'm not doing just any old ham and egg, run-of-the-mill kind of course. It's advanced, yo. Right, to park my ego for a second. Okay, yeah, as I said in part one, I kind of frenetically went over what I've been studying in a nutshell recently, and now in part two I want to share the short story I have written, trying to just give you a little bit more insight. The idea is for us, the students, to take the first assignment and then adapt it to either stage, film or radio. It was advised that you don't keep this in mind so much, just write prose, 1500 words, and then later on we'll focus on the adaptation. But I did realise as soon as I started writing that this would lend itself quite well to stage, because it's quite static, there's a small cast of characters, it would be, maybe it could even be like a three-hand sort of play. That's something else Stephen King mentioned in his book on writing, which I absolutely, thoroughly, 100%, totally, 1,000,000% pet recommend that book. He talks about his particular approach to writing is he usually starts off situational, and then the story develops from there. And I guess this is almost a subliminal thing there. I guess I've started with a situation, and the characters have risen from that, and then more importantly the story has been able to come through. This underwent, I think, 3 rewrites, which is unusual for me. I've had this habit in the past of just writing something, and then when I've collected, say, 2,000 words, you thought, ah, that's good enough. It's got, you know, some sweeping metaphors in there, and it's got some beautiful flowery language. That'll be fine, man. People will think I'm a genius, which is moronic, actually. I went back to this quite a lot and tried to really, as the saying goes, kill my darlings, tried to pare it down, especially language-wise. I think I've always, my strong suit's always been the descriptive, sort of cursive writing, non-fiction especially, and here I am trying to write a terse, almost Raymond Carver-esque short story is what I've been aiming for, where there's a lot that I've, idea-wise, I have going on in my head, but trying to condense it all down to get the narrative to thunder along with it inside of 1,500 words. And I think it's succeeded anyway. I mean, the danger here of writing with the door open is that it's open to the world, and people can then come back and say, ah, blah, 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 blah. I'll happily take on whatever critique might be given, especially if it's constructive, whatever that means. I don't think anyone in the world actually understands what constructive criticism really is, or maybe that's just me and I'm lumping everyone else in with my ignorance. But that was my intention here, was to write something where there was some very I want you to empathize with a specific character, and then for your allegiances to be allegiances. I'm getting like tangential all over again. Allegiances. I can't, fucking hell. Allegiances. It's easy to write. It's hard to say. To shift sort of midpoint. I want you to be surprised by some. But now I've said that there might be something coming, you're probably going to be waiting for it. But maybe not. Whatever, it's just a short story. I'm not Agatha Christie here, so it's not like I'm spoiling you Sunday night in front of ITV. Hope you enjoy it. I've called it The Plot. Here we go. Never done this before. Enjoy. Her chest rose by laboured degrees. At its nadir, her lungs capitulated and her sternum sank, as if she were an antique bellows in the face of a dwindling fire. Cupped around her in her home, like hands around one last matchstick, were her dearly beloved. Gathered here today in the royal box was daughter Elise and her husband Robin. The cheap seat was taken up by eldest daughter Viv.
from way back in the stalls she drew from her electronic cigarette. "Can't be much longer now," she offered, vapour slithering out between her teeth. Robin offered his wife a soft smile as she took her mother's hand. To Elise, the fingers felt like the drill bits she would pass her father when helping him make items of furniture in his workshop. She rubbed her warm hands across her mother's, as one might rub wet sand from cold stones retrieved from the shore. Elise closed her eyes and concentrated on the sickly sweet smell of her father's workshop. The paint and the white spirit always made her feel slightly dizzy, and sitting there thinking of it had the same effect. Mum had collected maybe 1,000 embassy cigarette coupons to kit out the workshop with all the planes, chisels and hammers a carpenter could need. Robin placed his hand on his wife's shoulder and offered to make her a cup of tea. "I'll have one if you're offering," came Viv's voice across the room. Framed in plumes of vapour trails that swelled when caught in the sunlight, Big Sis looked like some exalted monarch, Elise thought, reigning over her council estate with her electronic sceptre, the Mecca Bingo Princess. A carriage clock ticked over as Wendy's breathing soldiered on. Elise could count 3 whole tick-tocks before her mother's lungs filled. 3 more as her chest held up there, and another 3 as the air shuffled out through her mouth. Robin fumbled for a doily as he placed Elise's tea down next to her. He scrambled around for another doily as he took his sister-in-law her tea. "Just put it down. The old dear's hardly going to be bothered now she's on her way out." Elise scowled at her sister, who widened her eyes in return. Gripping her mother's hand, she tried to think back to that old workshop and tried so hard through the dizziness of the oil and the turpentine to remember her father. "Oh, Mum, I wish Father was here for her, Robin." "Give over, will you? You're in bloody dreamland, you are, kid. Daddy's never coming back," said Viv. Elise wished she could give her absent father the voice he'd chosen to give up and tell her sister to stop picking on him all the time. Your sister's upset, Viv," Robin stammered. "The eunuch awakes!" "Viv, come on. Do you think that you might refrain from imposing your..." "Shh! Look!" Viv leant forward from her throne, pointing towards her mother. Wendy's chest was suspended like a trapeze artist flailing in midair. All 4 in the room clutched that breath deep down in their lungs. Then there was a knock at the door. The knocking migrated from the door to the front room window. The carriage clock kept its tick-tocking regular. The knuckles rapped heavier. The window frame shook. Robin threw his stare across from his wife to his sister-in-law, like a spectator to a frenzied tennis rally. Neither blinked. Above all the din came the prolonged and even gasp of Wendy's breath released through her shriveled and tumescent lips. Viv let out a sigh equal in volume. "Silly old cow, she almost had us worried there." Robin fussed his way past his sister-in-law to greet the caller and offer his apologies. "Good evening, ladies." Both looked up to see a gaunt middle-aged man clutching a bowler hat to his chest and an ancient leather briefcase at his side. He motioned to the ailing and offered a mournful glance to the siblings. "Is this the deceased?"
"What? Don't be daft," shouted Viv.
"What is this?" asked Robin, nettled. Elise shuffled on the courtside puffier. She could have concocted some yarn to save herself the argument, but it was no use. Yes, she'd called an undertaker around before her mother had a chance to quietly slip away, but rather that than their ludicrous idea. It was baffling enough to her that they'd dream up such a thing, but what baffled her just as much was that Viv and Robin were united in agreement. "I'm sorry, is there some misunderstanding?" asked the undertaker.
"This is something, mine kid, even for you," said Viv. "The old girl would be laughing if she wasn't so short on breath."
Might I suggest we relocate into a more private area of the house," came the undertaker's suggestion. Viv led the gaunt man into the kitchen, never taking her eyes off his sister as she passed by her. Sat at the kitchen table, the undertaker reached down for his decrepit briefcase. He moved as if he were balancing an heirloom upon his head. He then, very delicately, spread out a selection of papers, nudging 1 or 2 forward in a very neat and measured manner. When he was satisfied that everything was in its place, he returned the briefcase to his feet and laid his palms flat on the wood. Viv interrupted the eerie silence. Fella,
sir,
Mr.
Bainbridge.
You're a bit early, son. Plus, we've all agreed on a home burial for the old girl.
I am not burying my mother like some dog. Like some dog. Listen to yourself. Drama, drama, drama.
Home burials happen all the time. You'd have it led by a horse-drawn carriage, you would.
Viv's voice trailed off as if her frustration strangled her words.
What about what she wants?
Mother wouldn't want this. What would Daddy say?
Viv's chair scraped back against the linoleum as she charged out into the garden, vapour whirring all about her, a steam locomotive with a furnace of flame. Cooling the atmosphere, the undertaker went on.
What's that you say about a home burial?
Oh no, we mustn't have that.
Might I suggest a perusal of our caskets?
He slowly poked a laminated catalogue towards Elise. You'll find our Northumbrian rages very popular. Maplewood, brass, fleur-de-lis handles, and the most exquisite purple satin lining.
Elise froze.
Miss? Asked the undertaker. Before we get the ball rolling, I just need to take some details. You are Mrs. Day's next of kin, I presume?
That's correct, yes, I'm a next of kin. Well, I'm a daughter, Elise.
So am I to presume that it will be yourself that covers all the costs? The undertaker inquired.
Yes, yes, that's right. Well, my husband and I, yes.
Robin gave an exasperated gasp.
Mr. Bainbridge, do you mind... Do you think you might excuse my wife and I for one moment? He asked.
I shall make a start on the paperwork, yes.
From the living room, Wendy's breath and the carriage clock went unheard.
Dear, Robin led his wife out into the garden. Viv sighed out another snake of vapour, took one look at the couple, and allowed herself back into the house. Robin positioned his wife neatly on the patio.
Now, darling, don't you think that was a little drastic?
Drastic? We're talking about my mother.
We're actually discussing the possibility of burying her down there next to the conifers.
Robin's brow furrowed.
Robin, please, I'm not saying I don't respect you or what you suggest. I really do. It's just that...
Robin grunted and scratched behind his ear.
Darling, please, just let me finish. You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, I'm sure it's commonplace and it's a done thing for some people. I just can't have that for my mother.
With hands on hips, Robin turned from his wife. He faced the conifers. A heavy rumble charged through the paving slabs. Elise wobbled, unsteady as a boy bobbing alone in choppy waters. She looked down to the trees and waited for the train. It thundered past, firing a murder of crows skyward. The hum of the rattling carriages entombed the couple in a noise so deafening that it seemed to slow time down. Elise watched her husband walk towards her, a fierce grin writ large on his red face. He was rolling his sleeves up. The noise very suddenly ceased. Robin grabbed his wife by the elbow and began to lead her down to the very foot of the garden.
Robin, you're hurting me! Not here, not now! Please!
With his free hand, Robin muzzled his wife.
Shut up.
Elise's wide eyes arced across toward the conifers. Her eyes widened again when she made out, obscured by a web of fuchsias, a small white cross planted into the ground. Leaning against the cross was a 10x8 of a man she didn't recognize. Viv watched as Wendy's chest continued to fight its way upward and then relaxed back to its starting point.
Hey.
Hey, it's me. Mom, it's Viv. You know, the nurse has always said to talk. They told us that you'd be able to hear even if you didn't seem to. Sometimes wonder how true that is. I mean, it's not like you to suffer in silence, is it, Mum?
Wendy continued to war with her body.
Viv looked on, thinking back to her father and how her mother's whole life had been a war. How her father was at the front line each time, launching his shells. Even though he'd taken off and neither of them heard from him again. Even when she'd carved out some happiness for herself with a decent man. Even when she'd lost that decent man, he showed up uninvited. He was always in the other room, the man in black.
Don't worry, Mum. You'll have your wish.
That's it. I'll read the commentary that go with it. It might help explain some choices or what the hell it's all about. This was a commentary I wrote with the assignment. I found the inspiration for my story from a newspaper article which discussed the rising trend of so-called pauper funerals. From here, I developed a narrative concerning siblings who were in conflict regarding their mother's funeral arrangements. This was not wholly fictional. I lost my mother last year and experienced some difficulty with my family regarding funeral arrangements. I did not draw directly from life experience in terms of the narrative, but whilst writing the piece, it dawned on me that I was exploring my frustrations via the characters. I initially set out with a vague idea based on Chapter 2 of A Creative Writing Handbook. I was fascinated by the literary device of conflicting points of view, but more so by contrasting characters. What I enjoyed about The Fly in the Ointment by V.S. Pritchett was the father and son characters who were in conflict and contrast. I knew I wanted to create similar tension, and thus drama, via siblings. I also enjoyed the idea of playing with readers' expectations, as Pritchett did so masterfully with the character of the father. With all of this in mind, I set about creating the character of Viv, who I wished to initially portray as a very unsympathetic yet very likable woman. I did this by leading the reader to believe she was indifferent toward her dying mother, sometimes even cruel, yet with her reductive humour could provide some comic relief from the dark subject matter. In order to successfully achieve character contrast, I adopted a third-person narrative so that I could explore Elise's perspective as well as her husband's. Elise contrasts with her sister not just in viewpoint but also in personality. It goes back to the porridge bit. Elise, in contrast to her sister, is well-to-do, a little snooty, sentimental, naive. By the story's coda, I hope I did successfully play with readers' expectations. I feel I carefully painted the characters, as in Robin, who I wanted to be a milquetoast type, only to reveal that he is an abusive spouse. The language and sentence structure section informed the moments of high tensions, particularly with Wendy's laboured breathing and the arrival of a mystery visitor. I tried to clip my sentences right down to a staccato so as to create greater drama. In terms of the editing process, I looked outside of A Creative Writing Handbook to Stephen King's On Writing. In here, King shared his first draft of what was to become 1408. He then compared this to an edited version, providing notes on his process. From this, I learnt to kill my darlings and be almost ruthless with unnecessary words and placing emphasis on the story at hand. This is something I also picked up from The Elements of Style, which King suggested as further reading. The piece underwent two rewrites, which is new for me. In the past, I have struggled with this aspect, perhaps being too precious about my work, so I'm very happy that I succeeded at tightening up the narrative and allowing the story to shine through. I tried not to think too much about the subsequent assignment, but whilst writing, it did occur to me that with its small cast of characters and relatively static setting, that the short story would lend itself to a stage adaptation. So that was assignment one of the course. I think the biggest lesson I've learnt through this is that I really do enjoy writing short stories. I've got my nose still into Raymond Carver's collected short stories at the moment, which I think really strongly informed the terseness and the kind of darkness of the plot. And it's really helped teach me to, I think it's the same with when I'm writing music, this kind of weird, it's not an entitlement I feel, but almost an expectancy that I can just pick things up and be brilliant. I know that sounds ridiculous, like I'm some prodigious, I don't know, it's almost conceited, I think, but I don't mean it like that. I just have this, I set the bar high with myself, and if I don't measure up, then that can stop me from further exploring these things. And I've learned that it is really hard work to write. Of course, with the internet now and with blogs, there's a lot of people out there, and power to them, you know, you can, that's why they're there, and you should have that freedom to go about and just do what you want, create your own entertainment, you know, that whole ethos. But then I think it's double-edged, really, because there's a lot of lazy writing out there, and I fell victim to that for a long time. It was almost just get a couple of thousand words together and then just whack it up on a blog just for the sake of, I don't know, some idea of being productive or having something to show for yourself. When really it's a slog, it really is hard work, like King's rally cry at the start there, like, you know, don't come to the page lightly. And I'm never, ever going to come to the page lightly again in terms of writing a story or a poem or this novel I'm working on. And coincidentally, my tutor made me aware that November is novel writing month. I've been too busy to start over the last few days, but I want to pick up later tonight. I want to make a start. The idea is to write 50,000 words across the month. That might sound daunting if you're if you've never tried to do that before, but it's achievable. You can do it, and I would strongly suggest if you do undertake it, get in touch. And I'd love to follow you through that process, because I think I'm going to do it too. Works out at about 1,500 words a day, which is absolutely achievable. Just bear in mind, it's a first draft. Just get the words down. Just lock yourself away and get them down, and you can do it. There's nothing to stop you from writing a book. It can be done in a month. And you know, believe me, maybe it's a year ago I would have thought that was ridiculous, but it is absolutely within your power to do that. So do it, why not? Fucking give it a shot. It doesn't have to be the preserve of the you know, the glitterati or the elite, the intellectual elite or whatever. Just, you can write a story, just go for it. Every day, catch an hour every day just to throw down 1,500 words. The next thing you know, God knows where you'll be. And that's my favourite part about writing, is if you do approach it initially as situational and let it develop organically from there, it's beautiful, the avenues that you're led down almost unwittingly, subliminally, subconsciously. You're led into these stories. King describes them as fossils for you to unearth, as if they're pre-existing and you're just uncovering them. And I think I believe in that. And that's the beauty, that's the magic. I think I'll end with the final paragraph, is it? I think so, of Stephen King's On Writing, because this, actually, I had to suppress tears when I read this. Being, as somebody who struggles a great deal with doubt and with self, you know, belief in what I'm doing, or, you know, just constantly distracted by choice and by different areas I want to explore, and not being able to focus on one area for long enough to get any good at it, that kind of jack of all trades type, but so badly wanting to put in the hard work now, really, really, really wanting this. This is what I want to do. It's beyond just, as I say, putting down a couple of thousand words and just chucking them up on a blog now. I'm willing to roll my sleeves up and work hard. It is going to be very hard work, but I realise this is what I'm madly in love with doing. So, finding the courage though to keep doing it, without wanting to sound too dramatic, but probably am sounding dramatic about it. But this final paragraph or so alerts me to the fact that any creative undertaking is a brave act, for many reasons. You are not just, if you share it, exposing yourself to the world, you're kind of bearing everything to the world, but in the act of creating, even if it's with the door shut, it's kind of a standoff with yourself. And if you fail, I find it harsher. Failing yourself is a lot harder than I've shared that now, and I'm happy with that. I haven't failed myself. I feel good about it. I might share that now, and someone might come back and say the thought was shit. I'll pick out faults in it. That doesn't hurt so much. That's fine, because I didn't fail myself. And that's where the courage comes into it, when you sit with the door shut and try to create anything for your own pleasure, for the joy of it. You're really putting yourself out there on a limb, really, to fail yourself. And there can't be anything more debilitating than that, really. That could stop you from pursuing any further, and you've just got to keep going. You've got to, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm allowing myself to make mistakes, and if I do, that's fine. For instance, part one of this podcast I thought was, I didn't like, I thought was atrocious, but if I'm going to be fair to myself about it, I did it ad hoc, rushed, with no preparation. So what's the big deal? It's ephemeral anyway. Yes, it's archived and it can be revisited historically by people, but that's fine. You know, the nature of it is it's all ad-libbed. So
Of course I'm going to say stupid things. You know, the Carol Ann Duffy poem I mentioned was written in the third person. It wasn't even written in the third person. I listened to that back and squirmed, but whatever. Who gives a shit, right? So yeah, I'll just end on this. This is Stephen King. Writing isn't about making money, getting famous, getting dates, getting laid, or making friends. In the end, it's about enriching the lives of those who will read your work and enriching your own life as well. It's about getting up, getting well, and getting over. Getting happy, okay? Getting happy. Some of this book, perhaps too much, has been about how I learned to do it. Much of it has been about how you can do it better. The rest of it, and perhaps the best of it, is a permission slip. You can, you should, and if you're brave enough to start, you will. Writing is magic, as much the water of life as any other creative art. The water is free, so drink. Drink and be filled up.